Hello, it's Owen Shehan here from Off The Ball, and the FIFA World Cup 2026 is here. And let's be honest, the matchday version of ourselves can look a little committed. Jerseys, face paint, scarves and questionable weather, whatever you have, maybe even a full costume if your team makes a run, you can look a little worse for wear come the end of it all. But the World Cup, it's not just about the football. It's the atmosphere, it's the nights in the pub, it is the watch parties with your mates, and maybe even meeting someone new. That is where Lynx comes in. As an official personal care sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, Lynx's premium fragrances are here to help you smell your best, even in the middle of full matchday madness. Lynx, smell your best when you look your worst. Now, enjoy your podcast.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Well, as always, there's technical issues as we get this live stream going. You're very welcome to this US Open watch-along where Wyndham Clark has laid down a marker. Well, we're having the theme music again, are we? No, we're not. Anyway, Wyndham Clark has laid down a marker with a 64 in round one. And let's be honest, nobody's even come close to matching it, including Wyndham Clark. And despite some early criticism earlier in the week, Shinnecock is playing as a proper US Open test. And to help me make sense of it all so far ahead of round four, our Gary Murphy, who's the only one of us with a chance of posting a half-decent score around Shinnecock, and Shane Ryan, who is at Shinnecock. Lads, you're very welcome. How are you both doing?
Very good, Fionn. Thank you.
I'm going to say intriguing rather than exciting so far. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's intriguing is a good word. I think it's going to be one of those majors in all likelihood where at the end we say, wow, what a great performance, but not particularly memorable. I think the closest thing to one I've been to is watching Martin Keimer at Pinehurst, where it's, okay, great job, but it's kind of, you know, at the end, it's just sort of, you know, kind of a procession at the end, kind of a coronation. So, you know, obviously it's cool that Scheffler got in the last group with him. That's good. You hope for maybe something to happen, but man, he's just been so good and so consistent. And when he gets in trouble, he's getting out of trouble. So it's hard to imagine anything really dramatic happening today.
Before we get into the golf itself, Shane, give us an idea of the atmosphere. I mean, one of the things that became so apparent yesterday evening was the lack of crowds post, you know, 6 o'clock US time. What was going on?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're out here on Long Island in the Hamptons. It's some of the worst traffic probably in the country. And there's also, you know, people coming out from the city. It's a hike to get out here. If you're going on the LIRR, which is the railroad that comes out here. And so people are leaving early, you know, if you leave at 8, you're not going to get home till 10:30, 11 o'clock. So instead people are leaving at 6 because, you know, they've got to get out and, you know, like you come to watch the golf, you're good by that point. And so as you saw, it was the case that, you know, Wyndham Clark, you know, when he made his shot on 16, the people following him had no idea how good it was because there was nobody up there to cheer. The stands were empty. It's, you know, part of it is the USGA starting. I mean, he teed off at 3:40 Eastern, right? It's so late. I don't know really why they do that, except that they want to get as much into prime time as they can, I guess, on Saturday night. But that's one of the consequences of it, is that your leaders, by the time they finish, you're going to have nobody there. And it doesn't look great when, you know, the stands are completely empty.
When the crowds are at their busiest, is the atmosphere good? Is it like, does it feel like a major?
Yeah, it was fine, right? I mean, it had that major feeling without it being like an exceptional major. I wouldn't say, you know, this is the greatest crowd I've ever witnessed, but there was some spirit there. There was some energy. You know, I followed Scotty in the morning, and I should have followed Scotty in the afternoon, and in the morning I should have followed Rory. I should say the front nine. In the but behind me, Rory was draining his 60-foot putt. You know, he was making birdies. He was making a little bit of a run, and there was some energy there, and you could hear it. I was just happened to be a hole away for it. And then in the back nine, Scotty, you know, started to make his run, and you could definitely get a little spirit going there. But it's not like, you know, this is not like Augusta. Even, you know, Pinehurst a couple of years ago, that had a tremendous atmosphere. This is not quite like that. So, yeah, look, you just need people in the stands for that to happen. And as the day wore on, there were fewer and fewer of those.
Gary, your thoughts on the golf? I described it as intriguing rather than exciting. Is that fair or would you disagree?
I think it's certainly intriguing. I think any time you have someone who looks like he's lapping the field is, can he keep it going? You know, he's kind of slept on the lead for two nights. And then obviously his third night's the hardest night. So, you know, can he do it? I think a Wyndham Clark can. I fancied him at the start of the week. I tipped him up on a few socials and that. And the reason being was that he's a wily, tough competitor. I think the Scottie Scheffler factor, I think that's a big play, him getting into that final group. Six shots is a lot, though. But we've seen Scheffler lose a six-shot lead. So we've seen him lose that in a FedEx final when, you know, it means the most outside of a major. So he's got that to draw on today. And I do think the opening few holes will determine a lot. I'm not saying it could be over before it started, but you're kind of looking for what's the course setup going to be. I think if they softened it a little bit, you have more chance of someone at one and two over shooting a five or a six under. And then Clark doesn't have to be that far off. He's going to be protective anyway. So I think course setup is going to be a huge feature. It seems like they're just going to let it run wild. And I don't think that does anything for the chasing pack, really,
no.
Because you're going to have to push. And we're going to see such a huge variance in scores from that even par to three over today. Whereas I think if it was a bit more, I'm not saying Thursday afternoon, but, you know, that was possible Thursday afternoon. If it's baked out today, level par is a phenomenal score. Yeah. So then you need a collapse from Wyndham Clark, and that's kind of where the intrigue is, really.
Shane, is there any indication from the USGA about what they want to do with conditions? Are they going to respond to the scoreboard, or do they already have a plan in place for Sunday, regardless of what the scoreboard looks like?
Yeah, so let's see. When did the round three setup information come? So we didn't get the email till noon yesterday about round three, so we don't know yet. But, you know, yesterday they sent the email basically saying that, you know, on Thursday and Friday, the speeds were in the upper 10s, and we're going to get them to about 11. And that's what they want. So they wanted harder conditions, and it's what they got. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, we had five guys under par. Is that right? Yeah, five guys under par, you know, compared to, I think it was 12 on Friday night. And so they do want it to be hard. But I guess that the biggest thing at Shinnecock is that it's always lingering in the back of their minds what happened in 2004 and a little bit in 2018. But 2004, they let it get really bad on Sunday. It was an embarrassment. It cost a couple people their jobs and their careers. Mike Davis took over after that. That was a big moment for him. He became the czar for the next two decades. And the reason that happens, and it's something that Bodenhammer had said in the USGA press conference, is that when things go bad at Shinnecock, they go bad very, very quickly. And so, look, they want it to be hard, but the biggest thing psychologically is that they don't want to embarrass themselves, and they don't want it to be a disaster. And this is not like Oakmont, where the difficulty comes because the rough is so high, and you can kind of control that, and you can kind of know, well, you know, it's not the conditions that are going to kill us. At Shinnecock, if you don't water the greens, for example, or you roll them too many times, or you mow them too closely or whatever, you could have a situation on the seventh green where nobody can get a ball to stop there, which is what happened in 2004. Or you can, you know, you can basically, it can happen on a number of greens where people can't hold it. You're, you know, hitting from bunker to bunker. The fairways are running out into the rough, even on good shots. And so they don't want that. And so the weather today looks pretty mild. I don't think it's going to be a ton of wind or anything, but I also just don't think the USGA is going to flirt with getting too close to disaster. So I would expect something at the hardest, like what you saw today. You know, as a fan, I'm rooting for the hardest conditions possible, because I think for Wyndham to come back to the pack, soft conditions are death. You know, it's only going to happen if Wyndham can make a quad somewhere, right? Yeah, it's not, yeah, you know, yeah. If you have soft conditions, he's not going to shoot worse than, let's say, 70. He's not going to, you know, be under par. And I don't think anybody's going to shoot a 62 or 63 to beat him. So, yeah, I think long and short of it, though, is they are going to err on the side of caution because they know how bad it can get. And they know what a disaster looks like because they've had it happen here before.
Gary, there was, I heard Bob McIntyre yesterday criticizing the pin position on 11. He was saying it was ungettable in that wind. I think you were saying there was gusts of 30 miles an hour. A friend of mine was in a WhatsApp group, was texting, and a friend of his was there, and he goes, look, this is like just a casual breeze at FOTA. It's not that windy. It's not that blustery. And then the other critique I heard was of the seventh, and Shane's talking about the seventh, which is, you know, one of the signature holes, but that, like, the green shape is no longer fit for purpose. It was designed when greens were much, much slower, but with these crazy runoffs, unless you hit that tiny, tiny target, you just can't keep the ball in the green on super fast greens. Thoughts?
Well, it's kind of, if these are 11 and you throw in the slopes, you're probably talking 14. You know, so try Photo Island in 30 miles an hour with them 14 on the stimp. And that's kind of what you're getting. It's like you would get it all the time in Ireland. You know, the captain's prize is on and the greenkeeper goes, this is on a slope. The greens are a foot and a half quicker than they are at any other time in the year. And that's the feature. It is like modern day agronomy does make some of these green complexes, you know, not obsolete, but unplayable. So I think, you know, and Augusta do it all the time. Like the seven's such a wonderful little hole. Just flatten out a little bit of it. You know what I mean? There's nothing wrong with it. You're not upsetting anyone. You know, if this was the design for a 7-8 on the stimp and it's 11 on the stimp, it's kind of common sense to build an extra 20 feet into the green. It's still the same shot. It's still, you know, it's just the punishment is not as penal. But the other side of it is these are the best players in the world. It's a new test for everyone. And the thing I love about this style of golf course, like nerve endings are absolutely frayed to the max, which they don't get. The only people that get that week in, week out are the guys in the final two groups on a Sunday, you know, or guys trying to make a cut on a Friday. But you have a situation here where the whole field is on edge. And it's day four of that challenge. So it's kind of a survival of the fittest, really. The curiosity factor is how free and easy the guys on even and one over are. You know, how willing are they to just have a crack at it today? Within reason, obviously. Because if this was any normal style course, you know, and if Wyndham Clark wasn't there, we'd be looking at a phenomenal showdown. But it's who can freewheel it out the back. And I'm not saying backdoor major because it doesn't matter. History will only have a name on a trophy. But that's who's going to make the charge today is interesting. But as Shane was saying, it all depends on the setup, really.
I will say, looking really quickly, yesterday at the stats, the seventh hole played a scoring average of 3.097. Seven birdies, 12 bogeys, only one double bogey. So it wasn't unfair.
Yeah. Okay. No. So actually that, there you go. So, so that the argument doesn't really stand up. I mean, like earlier in the week, the USGA is getting criticized. It was too easy. Wyndham posted 64 on Thursday and they said they were going to toughen it up and they did. And like tough, but fair. I mean, but like it's the US Open. We don't want a runaway score of 19 under.
Right.
Yeah.
No, but it's, I think Fionn, you got to just commend Clark. You know, it's they're bang on. You take him out of the equation and it's probably an overpower wins this. So he really and truly has played phenomenal golf. He's putted his eyes out for 3 days. Now, his only Achilles heel is driving. If he gets it in play today at a reasonable rate, he's, you know, it's going to be very difficult to see, unless we're looking at a meltdown. And I don't know, you never know, but I don't see him doing, you know, if he gets it in play, it's very difficult to see him losing this tournament.
Yeah. Yesterday, I was just reading, is that his ball striking wasn't great, but his scrambling was 11 out of 10.
It's interesting to look at that. And what I think we've seen in the past is that might be the only good indicator for the chasers.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to keep scrambling forever. You're going to make bogeys. You know, with the pressure, the heightened pressure today, it was remarkable yesterday, because as you're watching it, you know, everybody's natural instinct is hoping for a close major, no matter who's leading. And so you're looking at him going, oh, he's definitely going to make bogey from that position. He's definitely going to make bogey from that position. This happened, it felt like, four or five holes in a row. And he's making par after par after par. Oftentimes, you know, he's chipping it to 3 feet when it looks like an incredibly hard bunker shot or, you know, behind the green. Other times, I think there was a couple times where he made 12 or 13 foot putts for par. So that would be the only thing where I would go, okay, well, as you said, Fionn, his ball striking wasn't sublime. It wasn't like he put together the best round of his life. It's just that you just couldn't get the guy to make a bogey until 18, right? Until 18 when he made one, missed a couple short putts late, but before that he was almost invincible. But Gary, I don't know how you feel, but it almost reminded me of Greg Norman on Saturday at the Masters in 96, where he kept it together, but things weren't the same as they had been on Friday. And he's making a lot of putts. He's scrambling a lot. And maybe there's some indicators that there's some hope for the field. Now, I still don't think it's going to happen, but I would say, like, okay, if you're really grasping for good omens, maybe that's one of them.
Perhaps. And you know, I just think always, sometimes if there's a little frailty there, bogey in 18 last night is kind of, it's a bit of an ick. I think if we watch out, if you're looking at an in-running kind of market type of thing, I think if you watch his pace on the greens and his driving the first six or seven holes, I think if there's any issues to come, that's where it's going to come from. But I historically, and I don't have it in front of me, but you would imagine like a really rock solid ball striker and a guy that has his week on the greens, is they're the two components that win around Shinnecock. You know, if you look back to Koepka, he was an absolute alpha putter in his pomp. He won around here. Corey Pavin, you know, probably would have been selling hot dogs if he couldn't putt the way he putted. And Retief Houston had the greatest ever putting performance, you know, in a year where they lost the greens and he literally hoovered everything he looked at in the final round. Right. So they are the two big things for the guy to win this week, and Clark has done both of those perfectly. Like he's probably averaged, I'm going to say, 2.5 putts around, you know, over what he would normally do on a given tournament, and he's, you know, back to level one over par in the pack, and he's put himself, you know, given himself a 6-shot lead, but it still is National Open. It's always that factor. He did allude to it in the press conference last night. The fact that he won at LACC is a big help to today. And you have to believe that. But then Jordan Spieth had won the Masters and he played the back nine in an ambulance. So at Augusta. So you just never know with golf. It's the great unknown of what's going to happen. And then you've got, if they do let the course go, anything can happen.
Fionn, just looking at the strokes gain stats, he is third, to Gary's point, putting in the entire field, which is amazing.
His approach play, he lost strokes, though, didn't he?
He lost strokes yesterday, but overall he's 10th.
Okay, so that's,
yeah. Yeah, so yesterday, if you're looking for, you know, good signs, He did lose strokes in his approach play, which again, we could see that, right? He had to scramble a bunch of times to make par. Off the tee, he was good. Putting, he was 10th yesterday, which even with those two short missed putts at the end, that shows how good he was. I think, you know, putting is variable a little bit more than in ball striking, you would think. But you're just going to have to hope he sprays it today. That's the only hope. And that he can't scramble like a golden god like he did yesterday.
I'll put this to both of you. I mean, obviously, for the sake of an interesting tournament, I would like Clark to come back to the field. But then also there's that awful thing that in the bear pit that is the media landscape these days, like to the average golfing fan, Wyndham Clark has been reduced to just the guy who smashes up locker rooms, you know, and which is terribly unfair. Like, Shane, can you give us an idea? Like what do we know other than that? Like, you know, what do we know about this poor lad who, I mean, you know, and I include myself here, like, you know, I he's a lot more than just the guy who in a fit of temper, you know, took to a locker.
Yeah, I mean, he's also the guy who retweets election conspiracies, says that.
Oh, so he's not much of a dickhead. Okay, cool.
says that the protests, liberal protests, are staged. No, look, I my thing with Wyndham Clark is he's a complicated guy. You know, when he first, you guys remember this from a couple of years ago when he first started playing really, really well.
Yeah,
when he won at Quail Hollow and then won the U.S. Open at LACC. The whole thing was, he'd been through some very hard things in his life. He lost his mother. You know, he was an angry player as a young man, and he had to kind of find this like Zen. You know, I think he was into Buddhism. So this was the whole narrative around him, that he was kind of had controlled his psychology, all that. Then he kind of goes back, right? He goes back and he's obviously that one year where he back at Quail Hollow, he hits the T-Mobile sign last year. Then he smashes up the lockers at Oakmont and you go, oh, he's mad again. I don't care about the anger stuff. And when I say that, I mean, you know, obviously people should try to control themselves and not do these embarrassing things. But I do think that's a very human reaction. Some people are angrier than others. And, you know, I think it's more important that you take accountability and try to get better. Well, he didn't take accountability right away. You know, he was like, let's all move on. Let's all move a day later. Let's move on. But he does seem like he's taking accountability now and he's saying all the right things. But yeah, like, I don't know. The things that bother me more are like the crazy stuff on Twitter, the flirting with Liv, the kind of seeming bitter about Liv when Koepka came back, just all these things that I'm just like, this is not my favorite player. Like, to be completely honest, I don't like the cut of this guy's jib very much. But it's not because of smashing up a locker at Oakmont. I don't mind that. I like a little bit of that. But the other stuff I don't like. So, but look, I mean, nobody's perfect, especially in American professional golf. If you're going to do purity tests with these guys, if you want them to believe everything you believe, you're going to be looking long and hard. And if you're holding your breath, you're going to pass out and die before you find somebody who passes the test. So,
and speaking of anger, Jesus, I think it's the first time I've ever seen it. Dustin Johnson absolutely having a meltdown. Have you seen this?
I think I missed that. Was that that was yesterday?
Huh? Dustin Johnson, just coming off a green, just angry, like cursing at himself, giving out. Now, it could be, listen, again, as soon as I say it out loud, I'm like, was that AI? Like, maybe did some asshole just AI Dustin Johnson? I don't know, because we live in a world. But I guess the point I was going to ask you, Shane, was that is it the USGA have put in these rules that Joaquin Niemann fell foul of? And speaking of taking accountability, poor old Niemann chucks a sand wedge and then gets fined 2 strokes.
I almost wrote something yesterday, and I'm kind of glad I didn't, but I almost wrote something saying you shouldn't be penalized for throwing a club. As long as you don't hit somebody, as long as you don't hurt somebody. But I don't know if I stand behind that, because maybe you shouldn't set a precedent that it's okay to do a thing that could hurt somebody. And, you know, in all other sports, we tend to have these penalties for, you know, disorderly conduct or whatever you want to call it. But there is a part of me that's going, okay, we saw Rory throw a club last year, and I know the rule is kind of new. Yesterday, we saw John Rahm kind of kick a club down the fairway a few times. And it just leads to the selective enforcement problem, where I go, like, you know, who cares? First of all, he had like dinged the fairway before. He had done some other stuff that seemed to me more worth the penalty than what he did with throwing the club. Throwing the club, you go, you know, who cares? Like, it's just, I mean, yeah, it doesn't look great on him, but why are we penalizing him for it? So, but I kind of get it. I kind of get it now. I'm glad I didn't subject myself to the internet in writing that piece, but I still think it's just, I don't know. It doesn't bother me that much.
Gary, Brando Chamblee was on, and he basically made a case, and he's all in favor. He's saying the players are badly behaved, dropping F-bombs here, left and right, choking clubs. That part and parcel of a successful professional golfer is learning to control yourself and moderate your behavior on the course, which on the surface makes a heap of sense. So obviously, I don't think a lot of people would disagree with him. But then he makes this comparison between the nowadays, and he really kind of more or less says that Tiger Woods was the change, that the most foul-mouthed, that Tiger Woods was constantly foul-mouthed, but the cameras deliberately didn't pick it up. But that in the olden days, like, you never saw Palmer losing, blah, 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 blah. You never saw anyone else. Is that actually true? Or was it just that cameras just weren't, there weren't that many cameras around?
There weren't that many cameras. I think that's horseshit, really. You know, even 20-year career, like, and I have very, very good tolerance for the insipid golf that I play. And I played in Barbados a month ago, and I had a really tough time, and I drive the ball exceptionally well. And I got up on the last hole the second day, and I pulled my drive into a hazard, and I held the club in front of me and snapped it in two. And I haven't broken a club since I was a kid, I think. So, you know, sometimes, now I'm just saying from a player's point of view, if you align it with a setup that is a little bit dicey, and then you've got the person that's created this setup putting this new two-shot penalty in, that just pours petrol on the fire, really. So yeah. I'm not advocating throwing clubs and banging clubs, but I think if we're going to go down that road within reason, I think maybe a fine is a better thing than, because obviously the financial repercussions are not there, but it builds an awareness around what's happened. I think two-shot penalty for throwing a golf club is absolutely insane.
I mean, Neiman only found out he'd been adjudicated two shots when he came back the next day.
Yeah, I don't think that's a fair reflection of the action, to be honest. Mm. Because you can have, like, I played in a pro-am in Mount Juliet last Monday, and on the 16th hole I hit another very disappointing approach that basically knifed through my soul, and I had to hit a bunker shot afterwards, and I threw the club over to the bag. Now, I was never throwing the club at the bag to break it, but I was tossing it, and it was a bit of, I've got my putter beside me anyway, so I don't have to walk back there. But technically, I threw the club, and that's a two-shot penalty in the US Open, and that's ridiculous. So you can have a lot of gray on this issue too. Mm. I think when they've never really ever made a controlled effort to address pace of play, which should be a two-shot penalty, and they're doing this for throwing a club, I think the punishment doesn't fit the crime at all.
Well, let's get back to the events at Shinnecock besides just poor old Joaquin Neiman. A guy who perhaps could be understood for expressing his frustrations in a more visible fashion was Rory McIlroy yesterday, who, despite coming within, you know, he came within the conversation on his front nine, and then a five over back nine more put him out of the tournament completely, I would argue. I mean, he was making like a lot of acres of putt in the front nine and perhaps mass some greater crimes, but like, just Jesus, five bogeys on the backside. Mm. Any thoughts?
I think he's just a little out of sync. It looked like he was trying to hit a little cuts and was hitting a few pulls and trying to hit a few draws and hitting a few pushes. I don't think he's been on it all week. And the, you know, the brilliance of this test is if you're a little bit off here, it's going to make you look stupid and make you look like you're playing badly, and you're not playing that badly, really. You know, and then the frustration element, you just go chasing a little bit when you're not supposed to. And I think that's why, because he's not a million miles from being two or three under, and yet he's three over and he's kind of out of contention. And it's just been a bit of
yard drive on the 18th. His approach found the penal rough, and then the rough just made a fool of him on the way out. Like it just killed him, you know. So he ends up bogeying the hole. But it was a story of that kind of thing, wasn't it?
I know the wind direction was obviously completely different, but doesn't it just tell you where the game has gone from Corey Pavin's miraculous four wood into that green?
Yeah.
You know, Rory could have got a javelin and thrown it into the middle of the green after his tee shot. So, you know, it's sad to see, to be brutally honest.
Shane, you were following Rory on the backside, were you?
Well, I was a hole ahead of him on the front nine. And so when he was making his birdies, I saw that. And then, you know, the back nine, you know, this was almost like Rory in the between majors period. The pattern we saw where he would get really close, and then it was almost like the minute he kind of felt like we're getting there, then like he would kind of gravity would pull him back, which is what we saw yesterday. So yeah, I think, you know, Gary put it perfectly. I mean, it's going to make you look stupid if you're not very precise. And I remember I hung back after his third birdie on, I believe it was number eight, and he had a great drive. You know, he was down in the middle. And then he hit his approach off the side, and he ended up making par there. But it was an imprecise shot where he had a really good chance to make a fourth straight birdie, and everything, you know, I didn't know this was going to happen, but everything kind of went bad from there. So yeah, look, you're not going to have sustained runs on this course for very long, I don't think. And when you do, it's going to be a little bit lucky. And Scotty's a great example yesterday on the back nine, where he makes a good birdie on 10, but then he's kind of running in place. He doesn't seem like he's in the tournament. Then he gets in trouble on 14. He's off the back of the green, and you go, this could be it. And instead of making a bogey, he chips in for birdie. And then that spurs him. 15, he makes a birdie. And 16, he hits this incredible shot, the second shot. But again, it's a game of such small margins. This shot is way on the left of the green. One bad hop, or you know, 5 feet further left, and that's going in the bunkers. Instead, it catches the slope and gives him an eagle putt. And so you go, okay, here he comes. You know, Clark is going to start hearing the footsteps. He's going to hear the roars. And then what does Scotty do? Well, he misses two short putts on 17 and 18 that kind of kneecap his momentum and give us a situation we have now where it's going to take an historical collapse for Clark to lose. So I don't think Shinnecock is the place where you really, even though Keith Mitchell did it, in these conditions, you're not going to go shoot a 29 or a 30 on the back nine, I don't think. And so the only hope is the other guy is making a quad somewhere. You know, the other guy is melting down because of the pressure. And that's why I said earlier, I think if you're a chase pack, you want the hardest conditions possible, because you're not going to go shoot 65 on a Sunday. I just don't see that happening.
No. What about the likes of, you know, perhaps they don't get someone like Sam Stevens, who I will admit I haven't paid that much attention to in the past. Like, I thought he played very, very well. I thought, like, really elite ball striking yesterday. Just maybe just the putter was maybe a little cold, but like a really good performance, even though I don't think he's going to win. But certainly he's acquitted himself very well.
You kind of look at it and go, is this, you know, if you take out Clark, is this going to be an Andy North job? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's a few of those behind. You know, Tom Kim is interesting. He's young and precocious. Tagala's, he's capable of going low and staying low, but he's only won once on tour. Tom Kim has won once, I think. I don't think Stevens has won yet. So, you know, they're the kind of storylines can. But for Tagala and Steve, it's their National Open too. It's, even though they're kind of comfortable and enough, they're still in the busy end of the tournament. And there's, you know, all the other stuff that they would think of too, FedEx points and the top 30 get to Atlantis. So today is a, you know, even though they're technically out of the pressure zone of trying to win the thing, there's still a huge amount at play. It's just a pity that some of the others are a little bit too far back, but I think the saving grace is the fact that Scheffler is eyeballing Clark, and we might get, you know, a really good duel out of it if Clark can open up a little bit edgy. It could
Will
be a fascinating storyline.
That Scheffler's in the final group with him. Will it make a difference that Scheffler's in the final group with him?
Huge. Like, if you say how important it is, and I can't remember the guy's name off the top of my head. Like, when Shane Lowry was trying to win at Oakmont, he got he held a 30-footer on the last to get in the final group with Shane, and Shane wasn't playing with Dustin Johnson. I think had Shane been playing with Dustin Johnson that day, it might have been a different outcome. I think a final group pairing is, like, for Wyndham Clark, being the way he is, he would have wanted Scheffler. I think it might actually help him. But for Scheffler, it's imperative to be eyeballing Clark and going, I need to try impose myself here. You know, he even alluded to it last night, and I wouldn't have said it, but he's like, Scotty's the best player in the world. I wouldn't even have verbalized that, really. So, you know, he's not going to say Tom Kim is the best talent coming through at the moment, and I'm scared of him. But if he's going to be scared of anyone, or anyone's going to, if he's going to trust anyone to beat him at the moment, it's Scotty Scheffler, because he's the one that's capable of maybe shooting 3 or 4 under, and Clark doesn't do a whole lot wrong and shoots 3 or 4 over. And there's your math.
I mean, obviously the challenge is huge, Scotty. Shane, given that, like, Scheffler is an elite ball striker, he's a much better ball striker than Wyndham Clark, but Wyndham Clark is scrambling really well. He's having a, by any measurable standard, he's having an unbelievable week. But that, if Scheffler gets a couple of birdies early, will that frighten Clark enough, or is Clark, even now, like, he's got a major already, like, he's seasoned enough to know, all I need to do is shoot around level. I don't need to do anything stupid, and I'm going to win comfortably.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think, though, your mindset has to be, even on a course like Shinnecock, I don't think you want to come out with a defensive mindset. And I think if I were Wyndham Clark, you know, what you just said, that Scheffler is a better ball striker, is technically true, obviously. Yeah. But when Clark is at the top of his game, he is one of the best players in the world, and he is an elite talent. And we've seen that. You know, he rose as high as number 3 in the world. I don't know that at this moment Scotty Scheffler is a better golfer than Wyndham Clark. If I were Wyndham Clark, I would say, right now, I'm the best golfer in the world. I came in, you know, like, I won a tournament. I've been playing great, and I'm playing the best by far of anyone here. Scotty Scheffler, at this exact moment, on this exact course, is not a better golfer than me. And so I think that would be the mindset you want. And again, Shinnecock is a different beast than most courses, but I don't think you ever want to go saying, if I can just play careful and shoot a 71, nobody can beat me. I think he's got to try to make birdies when he can, because I just think on a Sunday, it's like, look, you're going to have those stretches like he had on the back nine where you're not hitting any greens and you're going to have to scramble, and you're not always going to scramble. You're going to make some bogeys. You might make a double bogey out there. And so I just think he should be going after it. He should be aggressive off the tee. He's got a lot of power. He's got more power than Scotty Scheffler. He's got all the weapons. I would just, you know, right, you know what I mean? That mindset should just be, I'm a thoroughbred. Nobody's going to catch me. I'm Secretariat. I'm going to race 10 miles ahead of these guys, and nobody's even going to sniff me today.
I just watched the Belmont from 73 on YouTube, just by pure fluky coincidence. Didn't Secretariat win by 31 lengths or something? Like,
oh, it's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. Sorry. A little horse racing lore there.
I do think another aid for Clark is, I'm almost certain he played in the final day with Scheffler when he won in Texas a few weeks ago as well, and shot 60 in the last round. I think it was 60 or 61. You know, so he's got, you know, he's got that going for him too, and that's a recent event that he can draw on. So I still think it's intriguing, because the course is, you know, if you look at John Rahm, like, John Rahm opens up with 68, everything's going perfectly, and he throws an 8 over in from nowhere in over the course of what, 12 holes, and misses a cut. So it's that kind of course.
He's also putting a snake in his hands.
You don't have to do a whole lot wrong to just get a little bit out of kilter. And if you get a little bit out of kilter with a lead and he starts playing bad movies in his head, then we've got a storyline.
Just want to point out, so Double Top Donal previous three rounds finished around 1:30 Irish time. Why so late, given it's Eastern time zone? I think, Shane, you addressed that earlier on. It's because they want to be in prime time for American television. So that's why they tee off late and finish late. Right. Daniel McCrossan says, we're all hoping for a collapse to make it exciting. It just doesn't look likely. I think, frankly, let's be honest, I think we all agree with that. I think any thought of a Scheffler kind of eating into the lead is just more wishful thinking than a realistic expectation, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so.
I mean, it's the thing that's killed me, because, like, obviously it's been one of those, like, I had dual screens. I was watching Kerry Armagh yesterday. I was watching whatever World Cup game was on early. I was watching, actually, the Germany Ivory Coast game is the best game of the World Cup so far, for me anyway. And so I have that on one screen. Then I've got the golf on the other screen, and I'm trying to keep it on top of all of it. And even though it's Shinnecock, even though it's the US Open, it's just not getting my blood going, because it feels like Wyndham Clark already decided this tournament on Thursday. And you know, it just feels like
it's funny the way it's gone. Since the drama of McIlroy winning Augusta last year, like, a lot of the majors recently, like Aaron Rye was kind of over with three or four holes to go. Poor Rush was over after about four holes of the final round. You know, the PGA was kind of over with Scotty. So it's, you know, there's been kind of processions in recent times. So maybe this is going to be another one of those, and we'll hope for Tommy Fleetwood holding a bunker shot to win in Birkdale or something to add a bit of color to the finish of the major.
As Fiona, I was just going to say, I'm surprised that you don't feel the same way about the World Cup, because the World Cup has its own Wyndham Clark with the U.S. national team. So everybody,
I can't wait for you to play somebody good. I can't wait. In fairness, look, they're obviously they put in very, very good performances. And actually, on that, has that penetrated beyond just soccer fans? Like, is there a wider buzz around the World Cup at all?
Oh yeah, it's great. I think there's a huge, you know, I'm not a big soccer fan, so I'm probably a good test audience for that, where I'm really excited for it. You know, the thing with US fans is that America's had some success in the World Cup before, where, you know, we've made the round of 16. I think we made the quarterfinals one year, but when we win, even in the group stages, the wins are typically like, you know, you get a lucky goal early on, you do your best to hold on, or maybe something dramatic happens at the end. That Paraguay game where you dominate and you look like you're watching Brazil, this is completely new. The Australia game where you just dominate play and then you just say, okay, we're up 2-0, we're going to get into defensive posture and just comfortably win, that's completely new. This is not like a U.S. team that we've ever seen before. And it's always been the promise, right? It's always been like, okay, in the 90s, don't worry, we're taking soccer more seriously now. We have 300 million people. We're going to be a great team someday. But the years have gone on, and years have gone on, and we don't look anything like Spain or Brazil or Germany or England or whoever. So this is completely new. I think everybody's buzzing. I think if you can get – so they're going to win the group. So I would imagine they're going to have a very winnable game in the round of 32. Maybe even in the round of 16. If you can get this team in the quarterfinals, I think you're going to have buzz like you can't believe. I think it's going to be good.
As a result, has that impacted, say, the level of interest in the U.S. Open?
No, I don't think so. I think it's pretty different demographics. I think the U.S. Open is just
old conservative white men.
Well, yeah, I mean, a little bit. I mean, there's some overlap. I'm not saying there's none. But I don't think it's, you know, like, the U.S. played on Friday afternoon. I don't think, like, yesterday, if you're looking at, okay, there's nobody there, or I don't know what the TV ratings are going to be, but that's going to be more about, okay, on course attendance is going to be more about where we are, the New York problem, the traffic problem. But ratings will more be about just one guy running away with it, especially today. I think today will be a case of you're going to have people checking the score, going about their day, checking the score. And they're going to look after the front nine, what's going on. And if Wyndham Clark is leading by seven shots, they're going to go, no, we're going to keep doing yard work. We're going to watch soccer. We're going to have a cookout with our friends. We're going to celebrate Father's Day. We're not going to turn on the US Open.
I mean, but like, that's both absolutely unsurprising and kind of depressing at the same time. You know,
it's right.
Like, right. It's, I mean, listen, not like obviously in the way we talk about the Gianni Infantino described the World Cup as 106 Super Bowls and all that nonsense, which is obviously insanely stupid because, but at the same time, the US Open, the final round of the US Open on Father's Day, on Scotty's birthday, Scottie Scheffler's birthday, his 30th birthday today, it's meant to be one of the signature sporting events of the year. And the prospect that like it'll gain scant interest because one of the leaderboard and two, actually, yeah, because just the gap between the leader and the chasing pack, I don't know, just feels a little bit disappointing. And but again, utterly unsurprising. And I feel that lack of enthusiasm myself. Gary, well,
think about this.
Go on.
To give you an example of two different coronations. Number one, Tiger at Pebble in 2000 continues to be one of the most famous major performances ever. Yeah. It was completely fascinating to watch it on the day. Second one, we talked about it before, Martin Keimer at Pinehurst.
Yeah.
Had a huge lead going into the last day, and it was utterly boring, and nobody talks about it anymore. Point being, if you have a coronation, you want it to be with someone great, right? You know, and then it becomes interesting. It's like if Scotty were doing this for the Career Slam, everybody would be watching. But when it's Wyndham Clark, it's not as exciting.
That's it. Absolutely. Yeah. Gary, are you
a couple of things. The only thing is if the U.S. do win the World Cup, you'll finally be world champions in something because everyone in the world is playing the sport. That's one thing.
Do you think the Irish baseball team could beat the Dodgers?
Well, apparently the Italy baseball team can beat the Americans. So,
if we practiced enough and threw a couple of billion at it, maybe. But I know you certainly can beat our hurling champions. So maybe Limerick or Tipperary last year are the world champions of hurling. But I don't know. I just think it's. It's that bizarre thing of, you know, the Grand Slam story is in Father's Day and it's his birthday. And I mean, it could be amazing achievement for one person, alongside a major collapse. So it's, you know, and the other thing, the cynic in me goes, it's Father's Day. Clark's not a dad. So that'll change the narrative for a lot of commentators coming in too. But I've enjoyed it because I like seeing the, you know, lots of the players frayed at the edges, which we kind of don't, you know, where are we next week at the Travelers and it's going to be, 22 under par, blah, 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 5 under cut kind of thing. So I always do enjoy the US Open. I do agree with one of the listeners there. 1:30 over here is a very late finish for Eastern time. And we have to mention that. We have to mention as well, Fionn, Stuart Graham won the amateur championship yesterday. So
absolutely. He won the amateur championship. He beat the American player on the last. And so what does he get? He gets into the US Open, the Open Championship. He's into Augusta.
Into Birkdale next month, yeah. Then Augusta for the Masters and, as Shane alluded to, Pebble Beach for the US Open next year. That's, so
listen, Stuart Graham, unbelievable. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
I think he's the seventh Irishman ever to do it, so.
That's fantastic. Come here, lads. Before we let yous go, let me put a couple of quick scenarios to you. Okay, so let's just, you know, we know that barring a collapse, it's a coronation, Wyndham Clark. Scotty Scheffler realistically is his biggest threat, but even then. What about Sahith Tagala? So Clark stumbles a little early. Tagala, he's good enough, has a shot-making ability, could make a run, but he's likely going to need something in the mid-60s, or someone like Tom Kim, who just can play some very fearless golf. Is that just mad thinking?
I got to say, I mean, where are these guys coming from? This has really been exceptional performances for both of them. Tom Kim has one top 10 this year, and it happened at the Myrtle Beach Classic, which is one of those, I think it's one of those opposite field events. Tagala, I'm looking at his OWGR now. He had a top 10 at Bay Hill. and in Houston, but I mean, his best finish since then is like 32nd. I mean, nothing in either one of these guys telegraphed that they were going to come to Shinnecock and be able to battle this course to one under. And even yesterday, I mean, even yesterday, I was looking at them going, they're going to fade. They're going to fade. There's just no way they're going to hold on. So I have to give massive credit to both of them. I mean, they have been similar profiles with these young, exciting guys, but they've kind of disappeared lately. So it's been awesome. I mean, could they make a run? Maybe. I mean, I don't know if I expect either one to win, but I have to tip my cap for them for holding on so long when, again, the form did not telegraph this in any way.
Okay. Lads, pick your winner.
Wyndham Clark.
Yeah.
I mean, do we even need to ask? Wyndham Clark. I'm going with Clark, Scheffler, and Tom Kim in 1, 2, 3. They're my predictions.
Gary, here's a question for you guys. What's the winning score?
Oh, I think 8 under.
5 under.
Yeah, I would go with Fionn. I think we're gonna have softer. The wind looks like it's topping out at 6 miles per hour. I think it's like 8 or 9 under. I think he's just gonna kind of coast.
Yeah, that would be my guy. You think 5, Gary?
Yeah, I think 5, and maybe Scotty might get to three.
Ugh.
That sounds right.
Bit of jeopardy.
And then there's the big sporting event of the day is Dublin Donegal later on today. So that means absolutely nothing to the pair of you, but it does to me, even though
is that in football, Gaelic football, hurling, football?
Yeah.
Donegal's an amazing little town. I'm rooting for Donegal.
Of course you are. Yeah, and Donegal will be favorites anyway.
There's 32 counties in Ireland, and 31 of them will be shouting for Donegal today.
Well, I mean, there's a pretty good chance Donegal, like Dublin, are not in good form at all. So anyway, it is what it is. As a dub, obviously, I want the Jacks to win. But anyway, not to worry. Lads, Shane, enjoy Sunday at Shinnecock. The weather behind you looks absolutely glorious, and thank you very much. I know it's very early in the morning, so much appreciate you taking the time. Gary, you can go back inside now and apologize to the wife or whatever it is that's forced you out into the car.
Yeah. Her cooking, actually. Did I say that out loud?
Lads, look, we'll come at you with a review pod on Tuesday. But as we expect, we'll be talking about Wyndham Clark. That's the narrative. Anyway, enjoy Sunday, US Open, and happy Father's Day to you both.
Happy Father's Day, guys. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hello, it's Owen Chehan here from Off The Ball, and the FIFA World Cup 2026 is here. And let's be honest, the matchday version of ourselves can look a little committed. Jerseys, face paint, scarves and questionable weather, whatever you have, maybe even a full costume if your team makes a run, you can look a little worse for wear come the end of it all. But the World Cup, it's not just about the football. It's the atmosphere, it's the nights in the pub, it is the watch parties with your mates, and maybe even meeting someone new. That is where Lynx comes in. As an official personal care sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, Lynx's premium fragrances are here to help you smell your best, even in the middle of full matchday madness. Lynx, smell your best when you look your worst. Now, enjoy your podcast.